The Sunstone Theological Society presents Afghanistan, Bananistan, or How I Learned to Stop Talking So Violently About Peace, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Gene England will be delivering his paper on Afghanistan, Bananistan, or How I Learned to Stop Talking So Violently About Peace. Gene's a professor of English at Brigham Young University, is a grandfather four times over, and I suspect is still trying to learn how to deal with talking about peace peacefully. I know he's qualified to do this. I participated in some of the research he's done on the paper. I've watched Rambo with him, and I'm not sure how to work that into his paper, but I'm sure I'll try. Without any further ado, Gene.
Thank you, Paul. He's responsible for two of those grandchildren, partly, and a half, right? One on the way. 2 weeks ago this morning, Charlotte and I flew over Pearl Harbor and landed at Honolulu Airport. The date was August 6th, the 43rd anniversary of the dropping of the atom bomb on Hiroshima. The papers were full of remembrance and commentary, reports of how many of the survivors of the blast had died the past year from probable lingering effects of the radiation, rehashing of the old arguments about whether the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki had been necessary. I looked into the faces of the many Japanese tourists and wondered what they were thinking and feeling. We wondered even more the next morning when we went to the extremely popular memorial of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, saw the movie, a combination of history and propaganda, and rode in a U.S. Navy motor launch out to the monument built over the sunken remains of the battleship Arizona, where over 1,000 bodies still lie entombed. The mood was somber and patriotic, even it seemed for the many Japanese present. The movie, like all tourist attractions in Hawaii, including the Polynesian Cultural Center, is quite careful not to alienate the Japanese, who make up a high percentage of their gate. It calls the attack the best planned and most effective initial strike in the history of warfare, referring to the Japanese throughout almost as respected rivals, with none of the hate-filled name-calling and racist stereotyping common to U.S. films during and after the war. The propaganda in this recently made film is aimed at American voters. Its explicit concluding message is that if we do not maintain our arms buildup and protective posture, Americans will have to die again in a surprise attack provoked by our weakness. Today I want to examine that assumption, though it is shared by most Americans, including most Mormons. That assumption is the foundation of an arms race which America began, has always led, and has continually provoked by technological leaps and massive buildups. We now build each day two nuclear warheads, not merely as large as the ones that killed hundreds of thousands in Japan, but each the equivalent of all the explosives, including those bombs, set off in World War II by all combatants. We do this, though we already have sufficient warheads to destroy not only Russia, but the whole Earth many times over. And though that buildup, in the view of many, is destroying our economy, and in the view of some, me for one, is destroying our moral strength as a nation. We do it, I believe, because we continue to take the wrong lesson from Pearl Harbor and Hiroshima, and to let ourselves become trapped in foolish rivalry with the Soviets, whom we imitate constantly in their worst practices, though we call them the most evil people on Earth. We have become victims of the oldest barbaric ritual in the world, revenge and scapegoating as we imitate our enemies' violence, with no help from our government and religious leaders, most of whom actually egg us on in the most fundamentally unchristian activities and emotions. Part of my joyful conviction of the truthfulness of the restored gospel and the divinity of its leadership is that at least some of our modern prophets have spoken clearly and courageously to this matter, though we all to some extent continue to ignore them. To help me talk about peace less violently this morning, I will use a few of these prophetic statements, only ones taken from major pronouncements to the Church and General Conference or First Presidency messages, ones that challenge me as much as anyone, and see if we can come together in approximate agreement about their meaning and implications for our efforts as Mormons to make peace. The first is from President J. Reuben Clark, who spoke about the horrors of World War II in the October 1946 General Conference, the connection most Americans would make, if we visited Pearl Harbor on the weekend when we were also remembering Hiroshima, would be the biblical one, I believe. They have sown the whirlwind and will reap. They have sown the wind and they will reap the whirlwind. Hiroshima, from Hosea 8 and 7. Hiroshima, with its deadly winds near the epicenter, seems a horrifyingly literal fulfillment of that natural law, as well as of the poignant prediction of Admiral Yamamoto, who planned the attack but regretted that his subordinates had pulled back without even greater destruction. I fear we have merely awakened a sleeping giant and filled him with a terrible resolve. He was right. Pearl Harbor became the rallying cry that united American effort and was used by our government to support a policy of revengeful, unconditional surrender that both made Hiroshima seem necessary and also seemed to provide moral justification. But listen to President Clark when he discussed the most terrible savageries, as he called them, of the World War. For most of us, Pearl Harbor itself, the German Blitz of London, Japanese prison camp atrocities, or the Holocaust come to mind as those terrible savageries. This Mormon prophet says no, that instead, as the crowning savagery of the war, we Americans wiped out hundreds of thousands of civilian population with the atom bomb in Japan, few, if any, of the ordinary civilians being any more responsible for the war than were we. Military men are now saying that the atom bomb was a mistake. It was more than that. It was a world tragedy. And the worst of this atomic bomb tragedy is not that not only did the people of the United States not rise up in protest against this savagery, not only did it not shock us to read of this wholesale destruction of men, women, and children and cripples, but that it actually drew from the nation at large a general approval of this fiendish butchery. What may have hurt President Clark most was the probability that his fellow saints approved of that butchery as much as anyone. I remember that I and my parents did. Right after the Hiroshima bomb, President Clark wrote an editorial for the Deseret News that, of course, carries no authoritative weight as official prophecy, but ought to give a sober pause, written by a prophet, as we consider today how the biblical prophecy, "They have sown the wind and shall reap the whirlwind," applies to the United States as well as Japan and other countries. President Clark wrote that the United States had perverted scientific truth, betrayed God's trust, and used the atom bomb without moral justification. And he made this frightening and today already partially fulfilled prediction. The bombs used to kill will become the aim and practice of all nations. Sometime our children's children will have it turned against them, that they too may be exterminated, annihilated. When that time comes, they will have no moral weapon against it, for we, their ancestors, will have cursed humanity by its first use. And humanity may be as depraved and Christian virtue as dead then as now. Our posterity must pay the penalty to the last farthing. This was not published, and in a cooler moment, when he revised for an address to Salt Lake churches in September, he changed the prophecy of the bomb being used against us in the future to "can" instead of "will." I'm grateful for that. But his essential warning remained and is coming true. The penalty we must parents and grandparents evil, the whirlwind we must reap for their sowing of the atomic wind, may not be literal nuclear war and destruction, but certainly it is the arms race with its gargantuan economic, social, and moral costs, and the constant wars such as Hungary and Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Nicaragua, produced by the rivalries and fears, the seeking for security and spheres of influence that are part of the legacy of our dropping that bomb. We are paying the penalty to the last farthing and last drop of blood. President Clark understood such penalties and the mechanisms that produced them because he knew the Bible and the modern scriptures and had great historical knowledge. He knew that no nation is immune from the penalties of ignoring the natural laws that govern ambition, desires for influence and power, violence in pursuit of those desires, and the revenge that violence always provokes. Through study of the scriptures and history, he changed dramatically from being a rather ardent nationalist and supporter of military buildup and just wars before he was called to the First Presidency in 1933, to becoming such an absolute pacifist that he opposed even our participation in World War II and constantly condemned as outright evil the military buildup and Cold War confrontation with Russia that followed the war. Most of the other general authorities did not take that position, and the church did not take it officially, though I find the main prophetic statements of our time generally consistent with it. However, I will begin instead with the rational, historical, and scriptural arguments that I believe underlay President Clark's thinking, and later quote the prophets in support. My thesis is quite simple, that there is a natural process which President Clark understood well, but which our government and populace has forgotten, that governs rivalry between nations as well as between individuals. That Russia and the United States are both guilty of imitating Germany and Japan, and then each other, in the development of national ambitions for controlling areas beyond their borders and military aggressiveness in support of those ambitions. That we are both about equally guilty, that finger-pointing and scapegoating little behooves either of us, but rather recognition that there are no bad guys out there whose change or capitulation would solve our problems, but that we are all sinners and must repent. That if we do, the equal and opposite natural process of escalation of peace can take place, as it already has to some and still very fragile, some small and still very fragile extent. The best scholarly work on the process I refer to has been done in recent years by René Girard, a French anthropologist and literary critic who is becoming recognized as one of the most important thinkers of the late 20th century. Beginning with a study of folk and classical mythologies and of classical literature, particularly the Greek dramatists, Shakespeare and Dostoevsky, and most recently of the Bible, he has developed a comprehensive theory of human interaction based on how we deal with desire, rivalry, and violence. The theory, for which he claims traditional scientific evidence documented in his observations, is gradually coming to influence thinking in all the human sciences and arts, and even some of the physical sciences. The idea is familiar to common experience and certainly to thoughtful students of Scripture, but Girard is the first to give it comprehensive scholarly description and application to the foundations of the processes by which societies, including religions, are founded and perpetuated. He offers persuasive evidence and argument that most desire is imitative. That is, that we want things less for their intrinsic worth and our real need than because others want them. Think of that for a moment. Why do we want things? He says it's mainly because others want them. Certainly, most American advertising is based on this principle. We desire and buy many things, often luxuries, mainly because a sports hero or rock star or movie idol or glamorous person, or simply, as some ads put it, one of the discriminating or the privileged, is portrayed as having or wanting those things. This may be relatively harmless, except as a waste of the Lord's resources needed for more important things like feeding the hungry. But it gets very dangerous when people or nations desire things that other people or nations have or desire, but of which there is only one or a few. Then the imitative desire turns to rivalry, competition, violence, imitation of the violence so that it spreads like a plague from one rivalry to another throughout a community or world. The most controversial part of Girard's theory is that at this point, by a natural process, the many rivals, threatened by the growing threat of violence that may destroy the community, fix on some scapegoat who is seen as the unique cause of all the trouble, is falsely accused of various evils, often those most horrible and threatening to the society, such as incest, bestiality, witchcraft, to justify violence upon the scapegoat, and the scapegoat is executed in a ritual manner. Girard claims, think of Jews in history, think of witches. Girard claimed, think of Mormons today, who are being scapegoated by conservative Christians. Girard claims, using powerful mythic and literary purposes, that societies found themselves, established themselves, on this successful means for limiting the violence that might destroy them. The societies then perpetuate themselves by repeating the process in ritual scapegoating that continues to control the violence, but also hides its real origin, and prevents the society from repenting, and thus truly and permanently overcoming violence. In his latest book, Girard makes the extraordinary claim for a modern intellectual that his study of the Bible has led him to the conclusion that it is unique among ancient sources in revealing rather than perpetuating this process. It takes the side of the victim and reveals the universal innocence of the scapegoats victimized in this process. It condemns the common sinful violence of us all that can only be overcome with repentance. On this basis, which again he claims powerful scientific evidence for, he testifies that the Bible is uniquely divine and true, and the message and example of Christ, the unique and divine solution to violence. He offers what for me is convincing evidence that the troubling accounts in the Old Testament that seem to condone violence, even attributed to God, are misreadings or simply descriptive of evil or inadequate actions and attitudes by the Hebrew culture still working its way through the violence mechanism toward the full revelation of Christ, a culture that God is working with but by no means approves of totally. And Girard demonstrates conclusively, I believe, what I've always felt and have found that the Book of Mormon teaches even more clearly, that Christ absolutely condemns all violence and the hatred that inevitably leads to it, and offers himself not as a traditional scapegoat, but specifically as an innocent victim in order to reveal the evil mechanism of traditional violence and to offer a way to end it by taking it on oneself in love rather than transmitting it onto others. This is what he offers as the meaning of being a Christian, of healing the evils of the world. It is what we must seek if we are to continue to claim to be a Christian nation, a Christian people, or Christians individually. Let us test Girard's theory against contemporary history and then talk with each other about the future. The discovery I've made this past year, which led to part of my strange title that somehow got you to come here today, is that it is very difficult for us to talk with each other about violence. I mean, it is not only difficult for diplomats from Russia and the United States to talk with each other, it is difficult for Americans, even for Mormon Christians, to discuss peace nonviolently. During various discussions this past year and presentations, I have been accused, sometimes in loud and angry voices, of heresy, communist sympathizing, impracticality, idiocy, all by my fellow saints. In turn, I have accused them of similar faults, including not being willing to live the gospel as plainly set forth, and have, to my later shame, let my own voice rise in angry retort and name-calling, which I found myself doing again yesterday after our panel. What I have learned, of course, is that the mechanism of rivalry and escalating violence, Girard has described, works inevitably even when merely discussing violence. Claims evoke counterclaims. Accusations provoke accusations. Aggressive and perhaps self-righteous proof-texting of the scriptures and the prophets produces the same in return. Being wounded and responding out of hurt hurts others and makes them more hurtful. I'll try to show I've learned something by using authority, as I hope I have President Clark, with full and proper context and limitations, by describing current history as objectively as I can, by giving both sides of an argument as well as I can, and by revealing my biases as openly as I can so you can take them into account. And let's try, in our discussion afterwards, to do those things. The other part of my title, Afghanistan, Bananistan, some of you may know, comes from the movie Hot Rock. Unfortunately not very well known, but Robert Redford's best comedy role. In it, he plays an inept, unlucky, small-time thief who steals a diamond, but in turn has it taken by a lawyer played by Zero Mostel and put in a safety deposit box, which can only be opened by a guard who knows the Mostel character. Redford's solution is to call in an old friend named Miasmo, wonderful name for a woman hypnotist, who successfully hypnotizes the guard and plants a key word in his mind, phrase, which, when whispered to him by Redford, will trigger a post-hypnotic willingness to open the box. If you can't see the... And that, of course, is Afghanistan, Bananistan. If you can't see the connection between all this and Afghanistan and Nicaragua, two of the countries that Russia and the United States have repeatedly subverted and directly or indirectly invaded so as to recreate the present hypnotic miasma of arrogant Cold War imperialism, then you just don't have the same kind of weird imagination I have. But let me try to explain how I see things, and then you can respond. My title is also, for some of you, a reminder of one of the great anti-war films, Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. With Peter Sellers playing a number of main roles, it uses comedy to emphasize two points I have made, that Russia and the United States become more and more similar as they compete in increasingly irrational suspicion and violence and imitate each other's desires and feelings, and that both have imitated Hitler's Germany in that process. Dr. Strangelove is a physically and spiritually crippled former Nazi scientist who leads out in developing our nuclear weapons, merely transferring his anti-communist paranoia and racism in his mad quest to give his country and world control from Germany to the United States. This is, of course, a caricature of Wernher von Braun and Edward Teller, but it is too close for comfort. We can ask ourselves seriously whether the tormented spirit of Hitler might be taking some grim satisfaction, that he has avenged himself many-fold on those who destroyed his empire by sparking in both the U.S. and Russia a desire for empire, politely called spheres of influence, that led them to carve up Germany and Europe and the hemispheres and to support continuing wars of liberation in order to maintain their global ambitions. Or perhaps even more devastatingly, by leaving behind the scientists who built the first ballistic missiles, the V-1 and V-2, as a kind of permanent infection to build and promote such missiles in the United States and Russia until both were locked in a continuing rivalry that exhausted their economies, their freedoms, and their moral character. A most horrible symbol of this evil infection is the Russian Army's use of the goose step, that straight-legged, boot-stomping marching style that is a perfect image of a dictatorial army smashing the faces of conquered peoples into the dirt. And though the Russians didn't get as many German scientists as we captured, or who defected to us because they knew they would be freer and richer here, so that we were able to start the nuclear arms race, to put our bombs and missiles in place, threatening them long before they could, even so, the force of imitation and fear worked powerfully to move Russia eventually to come close enough to catching up, to spur us to escalate the race again and again. And though Stalin pretended to be Hitler's natural enemy, he imitated his desire for other countries, even lusting exactly like Hitler for Poland, until he engaged in one of the most evil and horrifying pacts of modern times, the secret agreement with Hitler to divide up Poland, followed by the simultaneous invasions from both sides and the imitative atrocities committed on both fronts, the Nazi extermination of Polish Jews in the West, and the Soviet murder of thousands of Polish officers in the woods in the East. But we can indulge in no self-congratulation that we did not imitate such desire for dominion and willingness to use violence to obtain it. Between the wars, German theoreticians developed a new theory of war based on the limited but promising success of bombing raids in World War I. They suggested that mass bombing of urban centers of manufacture and of civilian populations would not only destroy the war-making capacity of a nation, besides its armies, but destroy its people's will to fight. And they advocated precisely that. American and British military leaders self-righteously rejected such thinking as immoral, and in the early part of the war engaged only in daytime precision bombing of military installations and factories. But then Germans bombed London, and the Allies retaliated by bombing Berlin. The Germans struck back with a blitz of London and the concentrated mass bombing of Coventry. We revenged ourselves many times over with a wholly unnecessary leveling of many German cities, especially Dresden, where 250,000 civilians were killed in a huge firestorm, and which again President J. Reuben Clark named as one of the great atrocities of the war. And all this prepared us, of course, to take what seemed a next small step with the firebombing of Tokyo and then the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But it was a huge step, because that made it easy when an increasingly mad Stalin took over Eastern Europe in 1947 by exterminating the non-communists in Hitler-like fashion to build missiles, arm them, and aim them at Soviet cities. We did that first, and the Soviets, having watched Dresden and Hiroshima, knew we were capable of firing those missiles, and of course imitated us exactly by building their own missiles and aiming them and following each technological advantage we gained by another imitation, and through it all increasing the paranoia on both sides. Perhaps the most continually dangerous form that paranoia has taken on both sides has been the insistence of each superpower on protecting what it presumed to define as its vital interest as at the expense of other countries around them. Russia used political influence, intimidation, and often violent force to build and preserve a buffer for itself in Eastern Europe. The tanks into Prague in 1968 and the intimidation of Poland in 1981 are only the latest forms of this, but for most of us, the supreme recent example of this Soviet evil is Afghanistan. This landlocked nation on the southern border of Russia was formed in 1747 by a tribal warrior whose successors in his Durrani tribe ruled until April 1978, when there was a communist coup. Through the 19th century, Russia and England both desired to take over the country, mainly to prevent the other from doing so, to form buffers, and gaining control of sought the other from taking over the Khyber Pass into India. This rivalry was balanced enough to keep Afghanistan mainly free, but the arrogance of imperialistic powers extended into the early 20th century as the two countries divided Persia into their respective spheres of influence and infuriated Afghanistan by consigning it without consultation to the English sphere. After the First World War and the Communist Revolution, the Bolsheviks encouraged Afghanistan to break with England and began providing arms to help them, a practice which continued into the 70s and was used as a crucial factor in the 1978 coup. Going to have to skip on. You've had enough history, maybe. During the 50s, the U.S. really missed an opportunity to be influential there peacefully by sending economic aid. Refused to, was more interested in arming Pakistan. In its rival with the Soviet Union, it's concerned to stop their supposed aggression, and this merely increased Russian determination to prevent U.S. aggression, and so it attempted to get into Afghanistan and to provide arms there. Although in 1963, the king of Afghanistan became alarmed at the unsettled rift with Pakistan and his prime minister's insensitivity to pressures for democratic reforms and replaced him, the course set by his prime minister, Daoud, of close ties with Russia was irreversible. And for the next 15 years, Kabul's foreign policy was as close to Moscow's as that of any non-aligned nation. But the failure that led directly to the coup was in the effort the king made to respond to growing pressures for democracy and modernization. And here's a story we see again and again there and in South America, a failure for moderate reform and to support it. Yusuf was a commoner, the new premier, and helped immediately to write a liberal constitution based on equality and personal rights. But the king and his family did little to develop a constitutional culture, continuing to favor the conservative rural landlords and to practice nepotism. A severe drought in the early 70s further alienated the political left and center, and the former prime minister, Daoud, led leftists in the military in a successful coup in 1973. He continued and increased economic and military dependence on Russia. But when he visited Moscow in April 1977 and was criticized by Brezhnev for not implementing land reforms or showing enough appreciation for Soviet aid, he replied icily, "I am the president of an independent country and not a member of your East European bloc." As he walked out, an aide whispered, "You have just signed your death warrant," a prophecy that came true just 1 year later. The KGB murdered a popular labor leader to create unrest as a screen, organized mass demonstrations by communist factions, and when Daoud arrested the communist leaders, communist cells in the heavily Sovietized military carried out previously laid plans for a coup. They attacked and claimed victory in 36 hours, the turning point being precision bombing probably carried out by Soviet pilots flying Afghan planes. Daoud and his family and close associates and 200 others were killed, assassinated, and a government was formed under Mohammad Taraki and became openly communist-aligned. The Soviet involvement is clear from the means and speed of takeover and the formation of diplomatic and economic relationships with the East Bloc. Its motives could no longer have been fear for its borders, as might be argued in the 50s and 60s, but had become imperial ambition, a desire to control Afghanistan's political and military system. Taraki moved fast to create a Marxist-Leninist state, too fast, alienating rural tribal groups, religious leaders, and the urban middle class, including trained civil servants. And by July, purging fellow communists he thought not radical enough, including Babrak Karmal, whom later events would show the Soviets considered reliable. Let me skip a little bit. Of course, it's this increasing resistance from the tribal units against this communist regime that finally led the Russians to feel they had something on their hands they couldn't sufficiently protect and control. And in December of 1979, they staged an invasion, pretending friendship up to the last moment. Babrak Karmal announced the coup from the Soviet Union and then went to Kabul to take over. The Russians had moved in mass by this time, executed the communist leader there, Amin, and requested military, political, and economic aid from Russia. Moscow justified its invasion on the grounds that it was responding to an urgent request of the Afghan government for help in repelling outside intervention. Whatever the reasons for this dramatic new step by Russia, its effects are clear. There was immediate, wide, and continuing condemnation abroad, not only by the U.S. and its allies and the U.N., but by communist nations like China. Carter canceled U.S. participation in the Olympics and embargoed grain, and more seriously, efforts towards U.S.-Soviet cooperation and disarmament declined dramatically. As Alvin Rubinstein writes in his excellent history, this action signaled the primacy of Moscow's regional geostrategic ambitions over global concerns for stabilizing U.S.-Soviet relations. Soviets have exiled more than 5 million Afghans and killed perhaps 9% of the population, 130,000, in a war marked with monstrous cruelties, not seen there since Genghis Khan, population bombing, wholesale destruction of towns, harvests, and herds, raping of women, intentional maiming of children with bombs disguised as toys. Those destructions sending people into exile, refugees, would be the equivalent in a nation 15 times as large, like Russia or the United States, of 75 million refugees and nearly 2 million killed. Nicaragua, what I've called Bananistan, is not one of the typical banana republics. It has an unfortunate history that has made it, though possessed of low population and abundant natural resources, one of the two or three most backward and poor in Latin America. There are two causes. One, a highly unequal social system in which the rich and elite have been disastrously repressive and irresponsible. And two, continual foreign intervention or manipulation. In the Spanish conquest of the 16th century, not all the native Indians were killed. That did happen in Costa Rica, and that's one reason that has been so stable. It was only had a foreign upper class, or middle and upper class, without native Indians to suppress. But in this country, as in Cuba and other places where communism has succeeded, not all the native Indians were killed, and instead became a permanent underclass, virtual slaves of the ruling European minorities, who, abetted by U.S. support and intervention, resisted any democratization until the Sandinista victory of 1979. These ruling elites continually exploited the country's wealth and increased their economic and class advantage until the overthrow of the last of the Somoza dynasty, Anastasio, who robbed the treasury and took into exile in Miami $500 million when 50% of his people were living on $250 a year. The Spaniards exercised control over the West Coast until 1822 and the English over the East until 1890. But the U.S. was also constantly meddling after it expanded into Texas and the Southwest in the 1840s. In the 1850s, William Walker, one of a group of American fomenters of revolution in Latin America, imposed himself as president of Nicaragua and received recognition from Congress. In 1909, the U.S. helped the minority conservative party overthrow liberal nationalist President José Zelaya, and then to keep pro-U.S., that is, pro-U.S. fruit company, governments in power, U.S. troops occupied Nicaragua from 1912 to 1925 and from 1926 to 1933. These client regimes signed away any right of Nicaragua to build a canal that might compete with the Panama Canal and created a U.S.-trained National Guard to preserve pro-U.S. stability. After the troops left, the Guard commander, Anastasio Somoza, created a pro-American dictatorship and built the Guard into the most heavily U.S.-trained and most corrupt and exploitative military establishment in the hemisphere, a chief goad to revolution. There had been many efforts of grassroots resistance through the centuries, led mainly by Indians. Unsuccessful rebellions in 1881 and 1912. From 1927 to 1932, Augusto Cesar Sandino led a long guerrilla campaign against the U.S. occupiers and their puppet regime and was successful enough to force U.S. withdrawal and sign a peace agreement with the president. But he was then murdered by Somoza's National Guard. He became a martyred hero to the people and gave his name to the Sandinista National Liberation Front, led by pro-Soviet communists that began armed resistance in about 1961. They had very limited success for 10 years, but when Somoza, after a devastating earthquake in 1972, about the time of the marvelous parallel natural disasters in Afghanistan that paved the way for the takeover there. After a devastating earthquake in 1972 took international humanitarian aid into his own pockets, even the upper classes and church turned against him and the struggle increased. In 1978, the Guard murdered Chamorro Cardenal, a prominent citizen and editor of the opposition newspaper La Prensa. His funeral was a rallying point. Strikes developed at all levels of society demanding Somoza's fall, and an armed struggle of 18 months finally succeeded, with 90% of the population supporting the Sandinistas. Somoza held on to the end, issuing orders from his bunker to the Guard to bomb cities that had gone over to the Sandinistas, and then with U.S. advice and promised sanctuary, he fled with the national treasury. The death toll, mainly among peasants shot or bombed by the U.S.-trained and armed National Guard, was 50,000, or the equivalent of 4.5 million people in our country, 75 times our death toll in Vietnam. The new government, though ardently nationalistic and in many cases deeply Christian, was openly Marxist and thus automatically viewed with suspicion by the elite, wealthy, land-owning minority and by the United States government. The initial junta like all revolutionary powers, exercised essentially dictatorial powers in an increasingly arrogant and doctrinaire way. Non-Sandinistas, though originally included, withdrew and began protesting. Censorship of items connected with the troubled economy or the beginning Contra War were censored, and elections were put off until 1985. The Nicaraguans had no reason to trust the U.S., who had continually intervened on the side of the oppressive minority elite, had handpicked Somoza to head the hated National Guard, and had stood by him to the very end when it tried to mediate a removal of Somoza only in order to prevent the Marxist Sandinistas from coming to power. When this effort failed because no other Latin American state would support it, the Carter administration, though unhappy, tried to live with the new regime and even sent token amounts of aid, openly designed to moderate the revolution, and channeled mainly through non-Sandinista groups like the church. Even this aid was suspended when Carter charged the Sandinistas with arming El Salvadoran guerrillas, and then the aid was entirely cut off by the new Reagan administration in 1981, despite evidence that the sending of arms was indeed cut back in response to the Carter condition. In November, the new Congress authorized the CIA of 1981 to assist overtly counter-revolutionary groups already operating against the Sandinistas, ostensibly in order to deter support for the guerrillas in El Salvador. But the Contras themselves made clear their purpose was the overthrow of the Sandinista government. Thus began what scholars are now calling Reagan's secret war, because its extent and nature remained largely hidden from the American people until the Iran-Contra hearings. We now know that it succeeded in raising the number of Contras from about 500 to over 15,000, and that these freedom fighters, as Reagan dubbed them in comparing them to our own revolutionary heroes, have won no battles and permanently occupied no territory, operating almost entirely from neighboring Honduras, in exchange for which the U.S. has extended massive aid, built huge illegal airstrips, and engaged in joint military maneuvers, all of which has produced responsive paranoia and aggressiveness in the Sandinistas. They achieved some impressive social reforms in the early 1980s, especially in literacy, which was increased to 88%, and from the evidence of the internationally observed elections of 1985 and the lack of growth or real success of the Contras, Sandinistas continue to have a popular mandate. But the threats posed by U.S. and Contra hostility have kept them on a war footing, with the consequent economic costs, the large army, reduction of civil rights, and suppressive activities such as forcible relocation of the Mosquito Indians on the East Coast, who were seen as pro-Contra, the kind of effects that occur in any nation threatened from without. Think of our massive imprisonment of Japanese Americans in World War II, for which we have now only now apologized and agreed to pay survivors $1.2 billion in compensation. What have been the causes and effects of this effort to overthrow the elected government of a state, not on our borders or threatening us or our citizens in any way? The public claim was at first that we were stopping support for El Salvadoran rebels, but that has proven specious. Gradually, President Reagan's public claim has become that Nicaragua is a Soviet client state, another Cuba, in real or potential violation of the Monroe Doctrine and a threat to our vital interests, especially if it were to become a Soviet base for aircraft or missiles, or a base for subversion of Honduras, then Mexico, then Texas. The trouble with this argument is that Nicaragua may be like Cuba in the terrible, oppressive, and dictatorial conditions that produce both revolutions, and which, by the way, do not exist in countries like Costa Rica and Mexico, and thus will not support a domino effect. But there is no evidence that Nicaragua is becoming another Cuba. Russia did not foment or support the revolution. When the Sandinistas turned to the Soviets for help after the U.S. turned against them, Russia made clear it would not subsidize another Cuba and has provided very little help and no strategic weapons. Cuba, despite all our fears, has not exported its revolution, and the Soviets have been remarkably compliant in not making it into an offensive base on our borders, despite their early attempts to do so in direct imitation of what we had already done on their borders in Turkey, where we installed missiles aimed at their cities in the 1950s. So why? Bob Woodward's book on the CIA provides a compelling answer, consistent with our actions in Grenada and Libya. Ronald Reagan and his ideological anti-communists, thinking they had a mandate from the American people to stop our supposed humiliations and defeats as Soviet power seemed to grow in the Third World in the 70s, sought to reverse the tide. As he told CIA Director William Casey, "I want to win one." What have been the effects of this obsessive purpose? As we learned in the Iran-Contra hearings, not only Casey and the CIA, but McFarland, Poindexter, and North, and the National Security Council, and many members of Congress who defended them, and American citizens who made them heroes, as well as the President of the United States, sworn to defend the Constitution and uphold the law, all these became willing to let that end justify immoral and illegal means. One, waging of executive war without consent of Congress, in fact, against their wishes. First time in our history we've had executives who have waged war, assuming with good reason that Congress would support them, but this is the first time it's been done against their wishes, so that it had to be hidden. Attempts to overthrow an elected government against specific provisions of the UN Charter we are bound by our own laws to uphold. Two, lying to Congress and the American people. Three, massive interference in a social revolution that might have by now much more effectively improved the lives of Nicaraguans and might even have moderated in the ways our violent attack will never succeed in forcing it to. And the Contras, who would not have continued to exist in any numbers without a recruitment and aid, and many of whom are former Somoza supporters, even members of the Hated Guard, have killed 5,000 people, the equivalent in our country of 400,000 lives. They have attacked villages, killed families, killed even American and other foreign visitors and advisors. They have even books, whole books, have been written about their atrocities, and they have been labeled by a Latin American visitorial group as one of the three most oppressive of civil against human rights in the Western Hemisphere, even much more so than the Sandinistas themselves. What is the difference between Afghanistan and Nicaragua, or Bananistan? The Russians openly invaded rather than creating a client army like the Contras. They have killed many more people and suffered many more casualties, 20,000 of their own. On the other hand, they have recognized their failure, if not their error, and are withdrawing, while our government continues to defend our actions and to plead for aid. Even the Democrats, in fear of the election, voting for additional humanitarian aid recently, which merely helps the reduced and demoralized but still lethal Contras go on raiding and killing. Strategically, the Soviets have a better rationale than we do, because Afghanistan is right on their border, where a hostile regime could indeed be a threat, while Nicaragua is somewhat removed, though still in our claimed sphere of influence. Is there a moral difference? I don't think so. We are doing exactly what the Russians have done in Poland, Hungary, and Afghanistan, claiming the right to use violence to change a government that we do not like because it may threaten what we have defined as our vital interests. That presumption by the superpowers of the right to define vital interests outside their borders and enforce them because they have the power to do that, I believe, is the chief danger to peace in the world today. It is the most likely potential cause of a nuclear war. It has been clearly and specifically rejected as a legitimate rationale for violence by modern prophets. At the General Conference immediately after Pearl Harbor in April 1942, David O. McKay of the First Presidency stated clearly the conditions under which war may be defensible, and then added that war is never justified, quote, in an attempt to enforce a new order of government, however better the government. Let me repeat that. War is never justified in an attempt to enforce a new order of government, however better the government. The Brezhnev Doctrine, established by Soviet leadership, of course, which claims that the Soviets have the right and responsibility to aid in wars of liberation, so-called, that aim to install or defend communist regimes anywhere in the world, and has been used to justify Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968 and Afghanistan in 1979, is certainly judged evil by President McKay's principle. But we have imitated the Russian violence very explicitly by announcing an exact parallel to the Brezhnev Doctrine, that is, the Reagan Doctrine, which claims that the U.S. has the right and responsibility to install or defend democratic regimes anywhere in the world, especially in our area of vital interest, the Western Hemisphere, and has been used to justify our invasions of Vietnam and Grenada and our support of the Contras trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. I have an important question this morning. On its answer, I believe, depends our chances for peace in the next decade and the meaning of our claim that God will aid and protect us because we have superior moral position. This is my question. Can anyone tell me why the Reagan Doctrine is not as much a violation of President McKay's principle? that war is never justified in an attempt to enforce a better government on others, and therefore as evil and dangerous as the Brezhnev Doctrine. Think about it for a few minutes. Actually, the case is more serious because Gorbachev, just last March in Yugoslavia, explicitly renounced the Brezhnev Doctrine and pledged not to intervene militarily in Eastern Europe. Yet our State Department leaders in both parties and both presidential candidates continue to claim the right to precisely that kind of intervention, specifically in Nicaragua. Not only that, but a chief Republican defender of the Reagan Doctrine, Senator Richard G. Lugar, former chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, in a recent article in Foreign Affairs, announced that, quote, much of the political attractiveness of the doctrine flows from the effort to go beyond the defensive terms of limiting Soviet expansionism to the offensive and positively promoting liberation and seeking to reverse communist or Marxist control over various countries and their internal institutions throughout the world. In other words, end of quote. In other words, what we have condemned as the evil communist practice of subversion of other governments and fomenting revolution against legitimate regimes is now a major and supposedly additionally attractive part of our own foreign policy. Charles Krauthammer, one of the authors and a chief defender of the Reagan Doctrine, defended its application in Nicaragua, stating as justification for using violence to overthrow that government the following reasons. The Sandinistas have reneged on promises to bring democracy to Nicaragua, methodically centralized power, suppressed the opposition, and militarized society. End quote. But he went further in claiming that there is similar justification for our giving arms to anti-government guerrillas in Afghanistan, our support of two non-communist guerrilla armies in Cambodia, and would be justification for supporting the, quote, anti-Qaddafi Libyan elements or Iranian factions less barbaric than the current regime. You see what this is leading to? Anyone that we think might be a little better, we can use force to support, even though they're barbaric themselves. That last comment, of course, predicts almost exactly what we subsequently did in launching an air raid on Libya designed to kill Qaddafi and getting involved in trading arms for hostages in an attempt to cultivate, quote, less barbaric Iranian factions, which led to the utterly disgraceful involvement of our government in the Iran-Contra scandal. Only last week, President Reagan finally admitted, in connection with the Ollie North defense, that in April 1985, he persuaded a Central American leader, probably in Honduras, to release an arms shipment to the Contras in violation of the congressional ban on all direct and indirect aid. That growing willingness of our government to disregard law in following the Reagan Doctrine is highlighted, ironically, in another passage in Krauthammer's essay, where he is defending efforts to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. He says we would not need to support an exile army against the Sandinistas, quote, if the United States could get Nicaragua to stop its efforts to destabilize El Salvador and Costa Rica by hauling Nicaragua into the world court at Hague. The terrible irony is that this was published in May 1983. There has been no evidence that the Sandinistas, even claimed by our government, have made any efforts to destabilize its neighbors since well before that time. But as part of Reagan's secret war, we began not long after this, in addition to open and then hidden and illegal aid to the Contras, to mine the harbors of Nicaragua on both coasts. In early 1984, the U.S., sent commando teams under CI direction to deposit these mines in the harbors on both coasts, and then to have the Contras announce that they had done it with press releases provided by the CIA. Although after 10 ships were damaged, including most of them non-Nicaraguan, and so people killed, including Russian sailors, the U.S. denied its involvement. Nicaragua took us to the World Court, which on 29th of November 1984 declared itself competent to receive the complaint, and on June 27, 1986, by a 12-3 vote, ruled the U.S. guilty of violating international law by, quote, training, arming, equipping, financing, and supplying the Contra forces, and supporting and aiding military and paramilitary activities in and against Nicaragua. And it ordered us to stop all such activities and pay Nicaragua for any damages. But in the meantime, on the 17th of January 1985, Having heard this decision that it would make a decision by the World Court, the U.S. suddenly suspended its talks with Nicaragua under the Contadora Plan, and the next day declared the World Court had no jurisdiction over the Nicaragua complaint, thus becoming the first country in history to withdraw from a proceeding of the court after having initially accepted its compulsory jurisdiction. This is very much like, and is revealing perhaps, our recent refusal to pay $500 million that we owe the UN because we claim it's not supportive of our interests. In other words, we'll support international law as long as it favors us. Now, my question is, have we gone so far in imitating the violent intervention in other nations by the Nazis and Soviets as to become the most dangerous nation on earth? This is hard language, which may provoke anger and resentment in you who, like me, love this country and perhaps know directly the terrible violence those other countries are guilty of. But I ask you to consider the Reagan doctrine of intervention as defended by Krauthammer and such leaders as Republican Senator Jack Kemp, who said during his short campaign for the presidency, "I'm for peace in Central America, but you can't have peace without democracy." Meaning, until people do what we want them to. Are you willing to support such a direct contradiction of President McKay's principle? And if, as one Mormon said to me recently, you just don't believe he really meant that, on purely rational grounds, are you willing to accept a world in which intervention is acceptable as a general principle? The fundamental moral rule is that any principle you accept must be acceptable universally. If we can intervene in governments we don't like, so can the Russians or anyone else with the power to do so. And remember Krauthammer's and Kemp's practical guides as to where intervention is justified? Wherever you think a revolution has failed to keep its promises, or centralized power, or militarized the society, or is a little more barbaric than some alternative you can support, or is simply not democratic enough by your definition. These would justify armed intervention by us, even more clearly than in Nicaragua, in South Africa, in many other nations in South America and Africa and Asia, and by Russia or others in those same nations, if they did not meet their standards of an egalitarian democracy, in other words, communism. In fact, Russia would be justified in invading America, whose revolution, in its view, was betrayed into the hands of acquisitive capitalism and of government by a rich elite rather than true democracy, and which certainly has become as militarized a society as Nicaragua. Would we accept a world where only might makes right? Have we indeed become, as we showed in our invasion of Grenada, a country with no more respect for law or borders than Russia? What can reverse these forms of rivalry and imitation that increase violence in our world? Hugh Nibley has pointed out that the scriptures consistently identify those who will be wicked, who will be the wicked, who will be destroyed at the end of the world, as those who are constantly scapegoating, who are pointing their fingers at others and calling them the bad guys. The only good guys, on the other hand, are those who don't identify good guys and bad guys because they're too busy repenting of their own sins and loving even their enemies. Such people stop the plague-like multiplication of violence as force begets counterforce and escalation by absorbing the violence rather than passing it on. This is what Christ did in his life and death and insisted we must learn to do to be saved. It is the only way of peace between nations because, as prophets have consistently taught, the same principles that Christ taught for peace between individuals, nonviolent, active prayer and love, are the principles for peace between nations. Let me just quickly read, for those of you who may not have heard it, their statement at Christmas in 1981. To all who seek a resolution to conflict, be it an understanding between individuals or an international difficulty among nations, we commend the counsel of the Prince of Peace. Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. This principle of loving one another as Jesus Christ loves us will bring peace to the individual, to the home, and beyond, even to the nations and to the world. I don't see how that could be clearer. A good test case for each of us occurred just last spring. It was one of a series of graphic examples of the horrible imitative violence I have described, when an Iranian passenger plane flying in a sensitive border area without proper caution was mistaken for a military craft and shot down by an American missile, taking almost 300 lives. 5 years ago, a Korean passenger plane flying in a sensitive border area without proper caution was mistaken for a military spy craft and shot down by a Russian missile, taking almost 300 lives. Was your immediate impulse on hearing of each of these two tragedies to call the first, in President Reagan's words, the work of an evil empire, and the second, an unfortunate accident? Were you horrified at the expected Soviet barbarity in the first, and on the other hand, anxious to find evidence that the barbaric Iranians had actually staged the second crash using already dead corpses? Were you caught up in the issue of whether or not we should pay the family's damages as if we could buy back our guilt? Because the point is that we are all guilty. Those were not unfortunate accidents, neither. They were both direct results of the tragically dangerous confrontations we perpetuate around the globe as we pose our force against the force of others and inevitably imitate their violence. There is another way for nations as well as individuals to reverse the cycles of violence and initiate cycles of imitating acceptance and peace. Christ, who lived such a way and said we must imitate him and his Father rather than our rivals and enemies, gave the proper pattern. Love ye your enemies and do good, and lend, hoping for nothing again. What a marvelous description of the Marshall Plan, the only Christian foreign policy of this century and the most successful. And your reward will be great, and ye shall be the children of the Highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be ye therefore merciful as your Father also is merciful. Judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Condemn not, and ye shall not be condemned. He's not just talking about judge not, and you will not be judged by God. He's talking about Girardian violence. Judge others not, and they will not judge you. Condemn not, and ye shall not be condemned. Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven. Do you see the pattern of positive imitation? Give, and it shall be given unto you. And to add from DNC 121, without compulsory means, it shall flow unto thee forever and ever. That, I believe, is the only way out of the hypnotic, plague-like miasma of the world where two superpowers imitate each other's evil, the world of Afghanistan, Bananistan.